Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Mathematicians might call it a null set. Regular people might say zip or zero or nada. Us? We're just going to call it the August Jobs Report. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday today, the 2nd of September. Good to have you with us. And we are just going to pause for a minute here and ponder the sheer zeroness of today's jobs report. It's almost zen-like, isn't it? In a workforce of 150 million people, no net new jobs? How does that happen? Well, it's a little addition, a little subtraction, and some rounding out as well. The economy gained jobs in healthcare, mining, professional services, and temping. We lost in manufacturing and telecommunications, mostly because of a strike by Verizon workers. We keep losing jobs in government. You throw in some downward revisions of earlier reports, and what you get is, on average, just 35,000 jobs a month for the summer of 2011. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains how slow, or as we saw today, no job growth actually means workers and the economy are falling behind.
Every day in America, a few thousand more people enter the workforce. They turn 18 or graduate college. A new immigrant arrives at JFK, or a mom sends her youngest one off to kindergarten and starts to look for work. So the most important number you need to know is 100,000. Heidi Shierholz at the Economic Policy Institute says that's roughly how many jobs we need to add every single month just to keep up with population.
So that's our zero. When you get a real zero on the number line, it actually means a big loss as far as what we need just to hold steady in the labor market.
Add that 100,000 to the massive layoffs we had during the recession, and Shierholz says
the total jobs gap is over 11 million jobs.
That would mean even if we got the kind of job growth we had during the booming economy of the 1990s, and that's not even remotely likely right now, it would take 5 years to dig out. Instead, job growth has actually slowed way down. We averaged just 35,000 new jobs a month this summer.
People have to face reality. We are just not going to have the kind of job creation that we've seen in the past after recessions.
Bernard Baumol of the Economic Outlook Group says the business environment has changed fundamentally. Keeping a lean and cheap labor force is now the norm.
The goal of companies these days is simple. How can we increase output? How can we satisfy our customers without necessarily hiring more workers to do so?
Which means keep the workers you're left with after all the downsizing of the recession.
And the proof is already in the pudding. We have an economy now that is actually producing more than it ever has before. We're able to do so with 7 million fewer workers.
There is a bright spot for those who have kept or landed jobs in the so-called recovery. Layoffs are down. That's not much comfort, though, to Bob Hansen and William Barnes. I met them recently at the Oregon Job Center in Portland.
Yeah, I just got laid off again. It's just, I don't know, it's hard right now.
I went to apply for a dishwasher position 2 days ago, and the position was only up for about an hour after I got there, and there's already 20 applications.
Based on today's job numbers, it might be a long time before these men and others find employment again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Just for the record, by the way, all the hype you might have heard today about this being the first time since 1940-whatever that the economy's added exactly zero jobs, yeah, baloney. I called the Labor Department this morning. They round to the nearest 1,000, so it could have been 499. Either way. No matter how you do your estimates, Wall Street was not at all enamored of the state of the American jobs market today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. So here's another item from the jobs report worth mentioning. The number of long-term unemployed stayed the same last month. About 6 million people have been out of work for at least 27 weeks. One thing you hear a lot is that there are jobs out there, but the people applying for them don't have the right qualifications. Economist and commentator Betsy Stevenson says that just obscures the real issue.
As high unemployment lingers, many have been asking whether the unemployed have the right skills for the jobs that are available. After all, there are 3 million unfilled jobs. In reality, jobs are like a highly competitive game of musical chairs, with both the unemployed who want a job and the employed who want to change jobs competing to get the available chairs. That means there are 14 million unemployed and millions more employed competing for the 3 million chairs that are currently available. That's a very crowded game. During good times, we typically have 2 unemployed workers per job vacancy. Today, there are 4 or 5. Yet many business leaders have complained that they are having a hard time finding qualified workers. But ask them to prioritize, and you'll find that they're far more concerned about finding customers than finding workers. Even among those making the claims, hard to find doesn't mean impossible to find. Some positions just require someone who is just right for the job, and that means searching hard to find that person. If firms really were desperate to find skilled workers, then those folks with more skills would find work easily. But older workers are having the hardest time finding jobs, and they have accumulated a career's worth of skills. When age, not education, explains how long it takes to get a job, we know that firms care more about cost than skill. The recession swept through our nation, eliminating millions of jobs and leaving uprooted workers in its place. It was time and place, not skill, that determined who got hit. We need to create jobs for these folks to make our economy great again. But let's begin by congratulating them on their courage as they battle daily to find work, instead of using this so-called skills argument. Not so long ago, these folks were integral parts of our economy, and they still are.
Today, as it happens, was Betsy Stevenson's last day as the chief economist at the Department of Labor. She's on her way to Princeton as a visiting professor there. If you've got a comment, no matter where you are, send it along marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Next week is the 3rd anniversary of the demise of Lehman Brothers, which makes it also the 3rd anniversary of the shotgun marriage between the government and a whole lot of this country's banks. Suffice it to say, some couples therapy might be warranted. Today, a key government regulator filed suit against a bunch of big banks, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, you know, the usual suspects, accusing them of stuffing mortgage-backed securities with mortgages that had no business being turned into bonds. Mortgages, in other words, that they knew or suspected would go bad. There is something to be said for punishing bad behavior, but at what point does going after the financial industry hurt more than it helps? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
The U.S. government has taken the same approach to banks as doctors usually take with patients. First, do no harm. In fact, the banks have gotten a pretty sweet deal in bailouts and stimulus. But now the bills are coming due. Some parts of the government are suing the biggest banks, which raises the question— will the effort to make banks pay for the crisis end up hurting all of us? Chip McDonald, a lawyer for the firm Jones Day, says yes.
I'd sort of like to see the mortgage market restored to health as opposed to fighting battles from 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
McDonald says more expensive lawsuits will end up hurting consumers because banks will recoil and lend even less. That would make it harder to get a mortgage. And then there are those who say the economy just can't take more doom and gloom. Ernie Patricus is a former Federal Reserve official who now advises banks at White & Case.
If we could just think about it in terms of the financial system, it just continues the cloud over the marketplace. For the country as a whole, it's not helpful.
But consumer advocates say the bad news facing banks is karma. Norma Garcia, the chief lawyer for the Consumers Union, says many banks reneged on their deals to boost lending and stop unnecessary foreclosures.
The taxpayers stepped in and bailed out the banks to keep them from failing. The banks were given an opportunity to do the right thing, and they failed to do so once again.
It remains to be seen whether another lawsuit will do the trick. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, online automatic backup designed for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically backs up files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other problem, files can easily be recovered. More information and a free trial by visiting Carbonite.com using the code Marketplace.
We're going to try just to see if we can do it to get through the next 4 minutes of the program without saying the word jobs. Not sure we can. It's that time on a Friday where we try to wrap up the week that was. Here to do that with us today are John Carney from CNBC, Felix Salmon from Reuters as well. They're with us live from New York, our studios there. Gentlemen, how are we?
Very good.
We're doing great.
All right, good. John Carney, the first question goes to you today, and I'm going to do it without saying that word. But in light of what we learned this morning, how long until Ben Bernanke starts buying bonds again? Quantitative easing 3.
I think we're definitely going to get quantitative easing. We're not sure exactly what form it will take, but it is going to probably involve them buying much longer dated bonds than they have been. Normally, the Fed comes in and it's been buying much more short-term debt. They're probably going to want to squeeze people out on the risk curve a little bit by buying longer dated. I think the next Fed meeting in late September will definitely get an announcement, if not sooner.
Felix, make that make sense in English for me. They're going to buy long bonds because what? They want to drive long-term interest rates down.
Which doesn't make a huge amount of sense given that the 10-year bond right today closed at less than 2%. We're at 1.99-something percent. You can't get much lower than that. The yield on long-term debt is not the problem here.
Well, elaborate.
So the problem is that the banks aren't lending, and the reason they're not lending is because they see no vibrancy in the economy.
Right,
they
right
are not convinced they're going to be able to get their money back.
Well, so John, help me out here. I mean, the president's going to give a big speech on Thursday. Everybody's thinking Bernanke's going to do something. What is there to be done, my friend?
I don't know that there is really that much they can do.
All right, thanks for coming
by. Felix
was
saying, the interest rates are at all-time lows. The government is locked into this this battle about spending, so mm-hmm it's not going to be able to spend more. I'll be fascinated to hear what Obama announces, you know, unless he's hiring all of us to work for the U.S. government. It's not really clear that there's a lot of good policy options there.
I got a job, man. I love my job. Felix, what do you think about what the president's going to say?
Well, I would love to see a massive, big stimulus, you know. Kevin Drum, the blogger today, said he wanted a $1 trillion infrastructure stimulus, and I think that would be great. Any kind of big government spending program offset by long-term cuts in spending growth over the next sort of 5 to 10 years, that would be fantastic. But there's just no political ability to do that. So realistically, I can't see what he can do.
All right, let's change gears here for a second and flash back to Ms. Moore's spot of a moment ago about banks and the bond mess and then the lawsuit today, and also talk about, you know, the robo-signing from earlier this week. At what point, John Carney, does going after the banks just make us feel good and not really do much good for the economy?
I think it's definitely going to hurt the economy to go after the banks, but I still think it's the right thing to do. That there's a lot of misdeeds. A lot of bonds were sold, as Heidi said, to things that eventually became agencies of the U.S. government and that the taxpayers ended up having to pay for the losses on. I think what we should do is go after the bad guys. And if we need to, then, you know, we could actually have a open policy of saying we're not, you know, we're going to give forgiveness, but we should at least go through the motions of figuring out who did what wrong.
Felix, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. The Wall Street was the villain in this, and they haven't really paid. The banks, which still exist, have been making record profits. The bankers, plural, have made about $2 trillion in pay over the past 5 years. They're the only people who haven't been hurt, and they're the people who caused the crisis. So, of course, we should be suing them.
Just because, I mean, quickly now, Felix, just because it feels good or because it's going to do something tangible and fundamental?
Well, the taxpayer will get money back, for starters, and we need money right now.
And
right,
we need to set a precedent that when you do bad things, and it's open and notorious, and we know exactly what you did,
right,
then you get punished for it. It would be much worse for us to let this just sort of say, you know what, you guys can do bad things because it's too expensive for us to punish you. I don't think that's a good precedent to set at all.
Open and notorious. Good phrase. John Carney from CNBC and Felix Hammond from Reuters. Thanks, you guys. Have a good weekend. Coming up, the downside of the Daily Deal.
Wow, that is so great that I can get this so cheap. And you get more excited about the discount than about the actual product itself.
But first, let's do the numbers. No new jobs, no optimism heading into Labor Day. The Dow Industrial skidded 253 points today, about 2.2%. Closed at 11,240. The Nasdaq surrendered 65 points. That's 2.5%. Finished at 2480. The S&P 500 declined 30 points. Also 2.5%. Ended things at 1173. For the week, all in all, not so bad. The Dow down 0.4%. The Nasdaq flat. The S&P 500 dipped 0.2%. Financial stocks were battered about in anticipation of the lawsuit over bad mortgages we talked about just there. Bank of America shares sank 8.33%. Let me say that again. 8.33%. Morgan Stanley down 5.75%. Citigroup debited 5.33% today. Oil stocks took a hit as Tropical Storm Lee shut down half the production in the Gulf of Mexico. Chevron drained 0.2% today. Bond prices rose. The yield, as Felix mentioned, on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. President Obama spends some time in Detroit on Labor Day. He'll deliver remarks on job creation and the economy. World Bank President Robert Zoellick wraps up a 5-day visit to China. And it's a holiday. You know the drill. Markets are closed. Don't go to work. Clean your barbecue. And if you just can't stand it, take the day to plan for work. List all the work you get to do when you can go back to the office. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. APM is another way to say that. I'm Kai Rizdal. The deal-a-day company Groupon has seen better days. It's trying to go public into a stock market that can't quite figure out what it's doing. Its profit-loss calculations, and they are mostly losses right now, have been called unreliable. But whatever the merits of its finances, Groupon's very business model depends on a lot of local companies being willing to feed the demand for all those eye-catching offers. So the scads of wannabe Groupons out there, and there are bunches, who are trolling for mechanics and spas and restaurants, are working really hard to keep merchants on their good side. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
Jennifer Williams owns a chain of 7 exercise studios in California and Florida called Pop Physique.
Lift the left leg up and up. This is it. Final 15.
Classes combine elements of ballet and strength training in a grueling hour-long workout.
Ah, it hurts.
Pop Physique offered its first deal on Groupon over a year ago. 2,000 people bought the $20 offer. Ever since then, Williams says she gets calls and emails from other daily deal companies trying to sign her up.
Literally every day. Seriously. Yes. And sites that I've never heard of.
Sites like SocialBuy, BloomSpot, PopSugar. The bigger players call too, like Living Social and Tipper.
I don't answer the phone much anymore.
The daily deal craze has gone way beyond the cut-rate spa visit. The market is expected to top $2.5 billion this year. Over 400 companies are scrambling to get in on it. Restaurant sites, newspaper sites, sites for your pet. If you can dream it, it's there.
The competition is fierce.
Dan Hess runs a site that aggregates daily deals and helps businesses start their own.
The largest sites have hundreds of salespeople, and they're calling, in some cases, dozens and dozens of merchants per salesperson per day.
And for businesses, it can be overwhelming. The big sites typically take a commission fee of 50%. The small sites take less commission but may not sell as many deals. Merchants also pay credit card processing fees and taxes. And Hess says the deal sites come with deals of their own.
Increasingly, those fees are negotiable.
On a recent Saturday, a couple dozen business owners gather in Southern California for a class given by the nonprofit organization SCORE.
Part of the question that I have here today is, how much discounting do you do?
Before you decide a business.
Marketing consultant Keith Kaplan says daily discounts are part of doing business now, but small businesses need to choose the right site.
If you get a response and you're a little teeny sandwich shop for 10,000 sandwiches, that's going to hurt your business instead of help your business.
Plus, the larger sites now ask merchants to sign exclusive contracts and may not pay them if they do business with others. Jennifer Williams has had that kind of deal with Groupon for nearly a year. She says it's allowed her to offer deals when she needs to, especially when she's opening new studios. She's opened 3 this year.
I think once you find the one that either reaches the most people or a very specific group, then you stick with that.
Her most recent offer, just a few weeks ago, sold the most classes ever.
And press, it's like you're stamping the sole of your foot up on the ceiling.
Over the next few months, as many as 2,500 customers will stamp into Williams Studios, just loudly enough to drown out the sound of the phone ringing. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Business owners aren't the only ones who need a strategy to manage those daily deals, you know. So too do consumers. That'd be us. Tess Vigeland, the host of our weekend personal finance show, Marketplace Money, is here to make a smart. Hey, Tess.
Hey, Kai.
So what do you got?
Well, I brought you a deal.
I love deals.
I know you do. How would you like to go and eat at Cobras and Matadors for $35 off your meal? Give me $35 and it's yours.
Yeah, if I... No. If I like Cobras and Matadors, but no.
Well, I bought it back in February.
Okay, wait. So February, March, April,
and
May, June,
it's
July,
expiring
August,
next week.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not going to get there before then.
You know what's funny? That's why I don't buy those things, because life is busy, man.
I know. You never buy anything you regret.
Right.
You never buy anything
right.
that you're a sucker for a
I
deal.
I am the perfect consumer. That's
you
right.
are a better man than I am. But you know what? Millions of people do buy
yes.
these things. And I tell you, we are hardwired to love this stuff.
All right. So explain.
Well, basically, this is our brain on bargains. There's a behavioral economist named Richard Thaler out of the University of Chicago. I'm sure you're familiar
yeah,
with
yeah.
him. He coined this term transaction utility to describe what's happening here. And basically what it means is we spend to save.
Okay.
Now, I talked about this recently with Suzanne Hsu. She teaches marketing down the street at UCLA.
You see something that is just an unbelievable discount to you, and you think, wow, that is so great that I can get this so cheap. And you get more excited about the discount than about the actual product itself.
So we just get caught up in the emotions of the deal. It's kind of how, you know, they put the candy right at the grocery register.
Mm-hmm.
So you make this impulse buy. It's cheap. It just add a dollar or two to my bill. Only here, of course, I added $35 to my
and
bill.
And it's expiring. So I'm gonna be not helpful at all and offer this thought.
Okay.
Think before you buy.
Of course I know, but this is also where they get you, because these companies are also well aware of something called the scarcity effect.
See, that's baloney, because there ain't nothing scarce about these daily deal things, right?
Well, what this is referring to is the limited time offer that's put on pretty much all these daily deals. Here's Professor Hsu again.
So you sit there asking yourself, do I want to let it pass me by and, you know, 2 days later regret the fact that I didn't go for that great deal when I had the chance? Or do I just want to go ahead and grab it and then figure out how to use it later?
And plenty of us, if not most of us, do the latter.
So give me the wise consumer takeaway here.
The wise consumer takeaway is that these companies are just like any other. They exist to separate you from your money. They know all the sweet spots. So you got to think really hard before hitting that accept button. You're going to buy this anyway? Are you sure you're going to go? Is it going to be an albatross around your neck to the point where you're just going to the restaurant to get rid of the stupid coupon? Not that any of that applies to me, all right? So you want this thing?
Yeah, no, I'm not going to take it. But come on back next month, and we'll see what other consumer advice I can give you.
Oh, thank you, Kyle.
All right, Tess Vigeland, the host of our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Tess, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a chance on a Friday to take a break from jobs and banks and more jobs to enjoy the news that didn't quite make the headlines. Comes to us the same way it always does, courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Matt Berger, senior web producer for Marketplace. What's your story?
Well, this week there's been some buzz in the food world around a photo that was taken by a Wall Street Journal reporter, which shows a water menu from a fancy restaurant in Los Angeles.
A water menu? What's a water menu?
Well, you know, it's kind of like a wine menu. It describes where the water comes from and what it tastes like. And
like, tastes like what? It tastes like nothing. Isn't that what you want out of your water? I mean, it has a bouquet of...
Apparently, there's a lot more to water than you and I know.
So instead of a sommelier, do they have a plumber?
John Haas, editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Earl Grey tea.
And why is that?
Well, the tea company Twinings is changing the flavor of its one of its most popular brands, and they're relaunching it as the Earl Grey. The Earl Grey.
Is it, do people like it?
No, they hate it. They're saying it tastes like lemon cleaning products or dishwasher soap.
Man, bad news for Twinings. Because you don't want to get on the wrong side of an Earl Grey drinker, let me tell you.
Absolutely not.
Your only chance is basically to run while they pull on their pristine white gloves. Or you are going to get an extended pinky to the face, my friend.
Millie Jefferson, director of Marketplace. What's your story this weekend?
There's a new study out with a message for doctors and nurses who fail to wash their hands. Think about your patients.
Wait, isn't that what they're supposed to do anyway?
Well, it turns out that signs that encourage doctors to wash their hands to protect themselves aren't as effective as if the signs suggest that they wash their hands to protect their patients.
I'm just alarmed that they need signs reminding them to wash their hands.
You would think that the people that are responsible for taking care of you would at least wash their hands.
That's like a pilot with the sign says, "Pilot, remember to look out the window."
Millie's very strict, actually. There is more where that came from on Rico and Brendan's podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download, and you can find a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And with that, we're out of here. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 253 points, 2.2% on the jobs report, one must assume. The Nasdaq surrendered 65 points, 2.5%. The S&P 500 sank 30 points, also 2.5%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, the tough transition from the battlefield to the boardroom.
I got out of active duty last year, and I've been unemployed for almost a year. There's chaplain jobs, but not chaplain assistant jobs on the civilian sector.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll be back here on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend. This is APM, that's American Public Media.